This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, pop music critic for Fresh Air and critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. I'm sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest Neil Gabler has just published a book called Life the Movie: How Entertainment Conquered Reality. The subtitle explains much of Gabler's idea, that the entertainment business has seeped into much of our political, social, and private lives. And in the book, he explores what he views as the good and bad effects of this. Gabler is the author of An Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood, and a highly praised biography of the gossip columnist Walter Winchell. Neil Gabler, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Ken.
Early on in your book, you use a striking metaphor for the insidious effects of entertainment that I'd like you to expand on a little here. You write, "Acting like an Ebola virus, entertainment has even invaded organisms no one would ever have imagined could provide entertainment." And examples of this that you cite are Timothy Leary's internet webpage for his own death, O.J. Simpson's murder trial, and the media coverage of Princess Diana. I wondered in what way you think entertainment is like a virus.
Well, it's like a virus in the fact that there is no resistance to it. It is irresistible and inexorable. It moves from place to place and infects virtually every organism it touches. Although I think it's, you know, clearly this is weighted as being a very, very negative thing, I'm really meaning this in a more descriptive fashion, that descriptively speaking, analytically speaking, entertainment cannot be stopped. There is no cure for it if one wants to find a cure for it.
You coin a term in this book, a lifey. tell us what you mean by that. What is a lifey?
Well, the thing was that, I mean, we're all familiar, obviously. We live in this culture. We're all familiar with the O.J. Simpson trial and Monica Lewinsky and Woody Allen and Sun Yi Previn and Joy Buttafuoco and Timothy McVeigh. And one can go on and on and on and on with these, you know, real-life melodramas that you know, inundate us on a daily basis. But there was no term that described these things. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that I would have to coin a term for a melodrama that was written in the medium of life. It was half life, and it was half a movie. So I coined this portmanteau word, the lifey. O.J. Simpson trial is a lifey. The Monica Lewinsky affair is a lifey. Almost every day, as I say, we get another lifey.
Yeah. Well, how do you, like, take specifically the Monica Lewinsky situation? I mean, how has entertainment affected politics and trickled down into that situation?
Well, in that particular situation, I think we've seen something very interesting and something which the press has had a very, very difficult time acknowledging. They've had a difficult time reconciling the fact that on the one hand, the public says, you know, they're sick and tired of the Monica Lewinsky affair. They don't want it anymore. They want the impeachment proceedings to end. And yet, on the other hand, if you look at ratings of cable networks, particularly MSNBC and CNN and others that deal heavily with the Monica Lewinsky scandal, you're finding that ratings are soaring. Now, how does one reconcile these two things? And I think the only way really one can reconcile them is that the public understands that the Monica Lewinsky case is not a situation of grave national importance, no matter how much political journalists tell them it is. And in fact, what political journalists are really doing is they're trying to justify their coverage. On the other hand, what the public is saying by their viewing of MSNBC and CNBC and these other programs is that they love it as an entertainment spectacle. And they're making a very clear demarcation between the scandal as entertainment, which is, you know, a very rich entertainment, mm-hmm. a lot of fun, and the consequences of the scandal politically, which they believe are virtually nil. And it really is something of a travesty to watch correspondent after correspondent after correspondent talk about the grave national importance of the situation again and again and again, when the public is really telling them, you know, you're full of it. What we're tired of is your pontifications. We're not tired of the scandal. We're tired of your pontificating about it.
Mm-hmm. You make what is probably the first known comparison I'm aware of to Joseph Campbell and Bruce Willis. what do the author of The Hero with a Thousand Faces and the star of Die Hard have in common?
Well, what they have in common is this. Joseph Campbell in Hero with a Thousand Faces was obviously trying to find a way of uniting myths across culture. And what he did is identified stages of cross-cultural myths, namely that the hero arrives, whether a myth is in a Greek myth or an African myth or an Asian myth or a European myth. And in virtually all of these myths, a hero arrives on the scene, usually coming from ordinary everyday reality. In the second stage that Campbell identifies, the hero enters this wondrous world, encounters obstacles which he has to overcome. And in the third stage, having overcome these obstacles, the hero returns to from whence he came and bears the kind of gift of his experience to ordinary people. Now, Bruce Willis, in an interview with Jay McInerney in Esquire magazine, talks about the stages of celebrity. Essentially, you arrive, you peak, you bomb, and you return. He interpolated one extra stage that Joseph Campbell didn't have in his schema. But in point of fact, I mean, Willis is really onto something here. I mean, what he's onto is that there is a real similarity between the myths and the mythic structure that Campbell identifies and the structure of celebrity lives and celebrity profiles. And if you read enough celebrity profiles, and you know, I hate to say it, but I've read thousands of them, you find that they really do conform to the schema. I mean, given the stage of the celebrity's career, you find that in Vanity Fair and in People and wherever, the celebrity is arriving, or he's peaked, or he's bombed, or he's now, having experienced all these things, come back to tell us what he's learned mm-hmm. from his life experience.
It's also, I think, amusing in your example, the fact that Bruce Willis is using the novelist Jay McInerney as his intermediary, you know, McInerney himself having also undergone all these stages in his own career.
Yes, the blind leading the blind, perhaps, in this case.
That's right. You say at one point that Elizabeth Taylor is, quote, as close to a theorist of the life movie as there ever has been, which I think might come as much of a surprise to her as it did to me. What do you mean by that?
Well, you skip over Zsa Zsa Gabor, who is one of the trailblazers in this process.
Yes, yes. You also talk about Zsa Zsa as somebody who's famous for being known as being famous.
Yes. Well, I devise in this book what I call the Zsa Zsa factor. And what the Zsa Zsa factor is it's really the kind of the highest expression of celebrity. Zsa Zsa Gabor, when she arrived on the scene in her own life movie, was neither an actress, nor a singer, nor a dancer, nor a performer of any sort. She simply happened to be the wife of actor George Sanders. And while Sanders was away making a picture in England, Zsa Zsa was recruited by a friend to appear on a television program in 1951 called Bachelor's Haven, in which she was a panelist dispensing offhanded advice to lovelorn viewers. And she was so funny at doing this, just being herself, that she became virtually an overnight sensation. And from there, from Zsa Zsa being Zsa Zsa, she was recruited into the movies. Now, Zsa Zsa Gabor hasn't made a movie in God knows how many years, and it's nearly 50 years since she made her appearance on Bachelor's Haven. But what's interesting is that though virtually everyone in America knows the name Zsa Zsa Gabor, almost no one can tell you what it is she does.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is the Zsa Zsa factor. It's kind of the highest aspiration of celebrity, someone who is known by everyone for having done absolutely nothing. Now, Elizabeth Taylor, I didn't want to interrupt.
No. I was going to say Elizabeth Taylor, who did do things early on in her career, but I would imagine in your formulation, went on to become, in a sense, somebody who was famous for being famous.
Well, the interesting thing about Elizabeth Taylor, and the reason I call her a theorist, is what Elizabeth Taylor understood is that once her career effectively ended as an actress, she could continue her celebrity by playing out her life. And it, in fact, at one point, she said, "I am my own commodity." And what I think she meant by that is that she had learned to commodify her life, her divorces, her illnesses, her addictions, her recoveries. All of those things were now her movie.
Mm-hmm.
Her movies were no longer being made.
And this
but her movie now was her life.
And this is an example of what you would call a lifey, someone's life movie.
That is Elizabeth Taylor's lifey. Elizabeth Taylor's lifey is, you know, the soap opera of her life, and it plays in the conventional media. I mean, to extend this metaphor, I mean, these lifeies play in the multiplexes of the conventional media, be they television or magazines or radio or whatever.
And I never heard that quote from Elizabeth Taylor before, but the fact that she could conceive of herself as a commodity, it makes me think, make the leap to Madonna, who is certainly in our time someone who commodifies herself brilliantly. Do you also see that as the example of Madonna as someone, an example of this?
I explicitly discuss Madonna in the book as the third stage in this Zsa Zsa to Elizabeth Taylor to Madonna troika, if you will, because what Madonna does is, I mean, Madonna puts a postmodernist spin on Elizabeth Taylor. Elizabeth Taylor literally, you know, lives out her life as a movie. What Madonna has done is, she said, I'm going to take the stages of my life and make my manipulation of those stages my movie. So this is a kind of Pirandellian twist on Elizabeth Taylor. Everyone knows that I'm very self-consciously creating a movie out of my life, and it's the self-consciousness of it that you respond to as a viewer.
My guest is Neil Gabler. His new book is called Life the Movie. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Neil Gabler. He's written a new book called Life the Movie, How Entertainment Conquered Reality. When I got to the end and you say that if lifeies serve only as a way to bring excitement to the otherwise dull routines and patterns of our own lives, they may perform an invaluable psychological service. To me, this almost contradicted a lot of what you said about this sort of pointless overstimulation and emphasis on momentary novelty of entertainment. Did I misunderstand that in a way?
No, I don't think you misunderstood it. I think that we reflexively respond to entertainment as a negative thing. But then when one looks at it on a personal level, when one looks at the psychological impact of how entertainment can infiltrate our own lives, and the context of that comment that you mentioned, the context is that we have turned our own lives into entertainment. Not only public lives have become entertainment, but at a very personal level, we have learned to turn our own lives into entertainment. And in so doing, we more closely approximate the vision of the good life that we want to have.
Mm-hmm. I did notice at one point where you kind of abandon that sort of note of optimism or objectivity is in the area of TV news. I think you reserve some strong criticism of TV news, the blurring of lines between reporting and celebrity mongering. You refer to Diane Sawyer at one point, for example, as, quote, a celebrity who purported to be a journalist. How do you think TV journalism is bad, and is there any end that you can see to this tendency?
TV journalism to me is bad because there is not that what I earlier referred to as this kind of apportionment between, you know, serious informational news and entertainment news. Now, entertainment news may not be any worse than informational news. The traditional press may not be any better than the tabloid press. I think they serve very different functions. What bothers me is that we are increasingly getting only one function. We are not getting an informational press. We are getting an entertainment press.
Mm-hmm.
And it dresses itself up to be an informational press. We have to tell you these things because, you know, you have to be informed. But it informs us about things that, you know, we do want to know about as entertainment, but we don't need to be informed about in any other way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's a kind of Gresham's law. Again, you know, bad money drives out the good. You know, entertainment drives out, you know, serious informational journalism. And that, I think, you know, that is something I fear, because again, I'm a pluralist.
Mm-hmm.
I want a world that allows me the opportunity to read serious analysis as well as, you know, tabloid entertainment, and I'm not sure the television news is serving that former function.
And can you see a time when it ever would? Is there any reason for it ever to, in its, you know, ceaseless demand for profits in the bottom line, what should ever make television news change?
Oh, nothing will make it change unless there is some kind of moral revelation, and I don't suspect that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in a world where Barbara Walters and Tim Russert and Diane Sawyer are honored journalists, we're not going to get serious journalism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I hold Barbara Walters in the book culpable in some respect because she is the one who really smuggled celebrity past the journalistic guard dogs on television and gave us an interview with the President of the United States and with some, you know, soap opera hunk, you know, side by side as if the two were equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is something that I think that level of equivalency is something that, you know, television does, television news does all the time. And Barbara Walters is kind of the signpost of it.
That's Neil Gabler, the author of Life the Movie, How Entertainment Conquered Reality.